Monte Carson laid the three telegraph message forms on his desk, his eyes fixed beyond the open door to the sheriff's office in Big Rock, Colorado. The first report came from the warden at Yuma Prison, detailing the depredations committed by the escapees in Arizona.
Brutal bastards.
The other two came from Utah, swollen to a gang now. The murders and robberies grew larger in scope. The third incident had included the information that the gang had last been seen headed for Wyoming. That gave him pause to think. Then he slapped an open palm on his desk.
Whoa!
Which caused the jailer, Monty's friend of years, to jump.
Abner, I think this is a good time for that little vacation I've been promising myself. Getting a little fishing, spoil myself with fancy food in Denver, visit friends.
Like Smoke Jensen, for instance.
Am I that transparent?
With them telegraphs on your desk and Smoke headed into the same country, don't take a locomotive designer to know what's in your head.
Smoke's bound for the Yellowstone country, and he's the most valuable friend I've got.
You figure to go it all alone?
I reckon Hank Evans might make good company. If I push it, I might catch up before this mob of killers finds Smoke.
Specter, his partners, and their gang, 38 strong now, entered Wyoming by way of Flaming Gorge. Everywhere they looked, beauty surrounded them. The delicate pastel greens of aspen and cottonwood set the air to shimmering as their foliage quaked in the steady breeze. Earth tones ranged from black loam to yellow, white, ochre, burnt umber, and red orange, showing up in strata of rock and soil that undulated along the raw faces of the eroded canyon walls. A cheery blue stream burbled along over water-smoothed pebbles. Wildflowers nodded and bobbed in a riot of yellow buttercups, blue violets, bright red lady slippers, and fields of white-petaled daisies. Birds twittered and trilled their mating calls from every point of the compass. Sadly, all of nature's splendor went unnoticed by the grim-faced riders, who kept their heads straight, eyes on the trail. Only the scout, half a mile ahead on point, observed and appreciated this peaceful environment. For a moment, it profoundly touched his inner self. Sighing, his eyes misted slightly. He even gave thought to putting his spurs to his mount and riding the hell away from the nest of vipers he had joined. Then the reality of the huge amount of money they had been offered reined in his conscience, and he went about his job as expected. At 11:30, he picked their Noonan site and began to gather firewood. After putting away a tin plate of warmed-over sow belly and beans, Victor Specter selected 7 hard-faced, humorless outlaws and called them together out of hearing of the rest of the gang.
I have a special job for you men. While we ride on into Wyoming, I want you to take supplies enough for 8 days and head southeast into Colorado. There, you will grab a certain woman and bring her back to the little town of Du Bois. Think you can do that without any problems?
Nate Miller drew himself up, thumbs hooked behind the buckle of his cartridge belt.
Sure, Mr. Specter. Nothing to it. Where is it we're going?
Your target is the Sugarloaf. That's the ranch owned by Smoke Jensen.
Soft breezes, heavily perfumed, sighed across the rippling grass on the northern slopes of the Green Mountains. Smoke Jensen had located a low pass, hardly more than a gentle incline to a swayback saddle, and beyond the notch, a rolling scarp, carpeted in rich green buffalo grass that had already grown belly high on Thunder. In the distance, beyond the last rampart, Smoke noted a thin gray column of wood smoke. If Smoke recalled correctly, that would be the digs of Mule Shoe Granger, an old-timer who clung to the ways of the trappers, regardless of little or no market for pelts. Granger had a Shoshone wife and, as Smoke recalled, 4 kids the last time he'd been through. Smiling, Smoke altered course to put him in line with the cook fire's stream. Halting some 50 yards from the log-fronted building dug into the hillside, Smoke raised an empty right hand and hailed the bent, bow-legged figure who had paused to study his approach.
Hello, the cabin! Is that you, Muleshoe? I'm Smoke Jensen. May I ride on in?
Why, sure. Come on in. We's fixing to take a bite to eat. Join us.
I'd be obliged.
Muleshoe's family had grown to 7. Those under 12 were buck naked, sun-browned like berries. The youngest was a mere toddler who clung shyly to the skirt of his mother's elk-skin dress and peeped around her ample hips at the stranger. While they ate, Muleshoe Granger gave Smoke Jensen a fisheye from time to time. Then he licked the gravy from an elk stew off his fingers and gave a curt nod.
Seems as how I should know you. As I recall, we met long whiles back. Ain't you old Preacher's sidekick?
That I am, and I've been through these parts several times on my own.
That a fact. Well, they say the first thing goes is the memory.
Yeah, must be true.
Smoke gave a nod toward the younger children.
At least it's not something else.
Where are you getting at, Smoke?
Last time I visited your digs was about 10 years ago. You had only 4 children then, as I recall.
Nope, it was 3. But by jing, you got the right of it there. Plenty of lead in the old pencil. Moonraven's carrying another in the oven right now.
Well, that's good to hear. You know you two bake up some mighty fine-looking youngins.
The pride of Granger Valley.
You named the place then?
Yep, had to. Folks is moving in faster than fleas. Why, I've got a neighbor all crowded up to me, cheek by jowl. He's not more than 10 miles over to the east, and I had to file with the territorial government to hold what's mine.
Yeah, civilization spoils everything, doesn't it?
Yep, there's powerful truth in those words. Now, are you real pressed for time, or do you figure to stay the night? The youngins would love to hear some tales about Preacher.
Oh, I'm not in that great a hurry. If you'll put up with me, I'd be pleased to spend the night.
That's good. Being as who you are and where, it might be best. From what I hear, you might be riding into some real danger.
How's that?
Oh, a friend of mine rode through the day before yesterday, told me about a whole passel of men riding grim and hard in the saddle to the west of us. Says they come up out of Utah.
With evening coming on, Victor Spector, Ralph Tinsdale, and Olin Buckner had settled in camp stools at the front of one of the 3 Sibley tents they had acquired along the way. A decanter of whiskey gave off long amber shafts of brightness in the flicker of the firelight as it passed from hand to hand. From all the outward appearance of conviviality, though, tension fairly crackled from one man to the next.
This protracted journey across the wilderness is becoming burdensome, Victor. I've never been much of a horseman. My rump and thighs still ache after each day's ride.
You'll toughen up soon enough, Olin.
If our purpose remains the same, to revenge ourselves on Smoke Jensen, then why don't we simply head to the Sugarloaf and kill him in his own yard?
For one thing, it would be too quick and too easy. I want Smoke Jensen to die slowly and hurt a great deal while doing it. Then there's the fact that Colorado is quite civilized now. There are trains and the telegraph, thousands of residents and competent lawmen.
Specter did not go quite so far as to admit that he feared being trapped in the more populous country around the Sugarloaf. Not by the law, but rather by Smoke Jensen. Just Yeager approached.
Mr. Specter, the men are getting downright antsy. They want for the walls of a saloon around them, some good whiskey and some women to tussle with. When are we going to get around city lights again?
In due time. What's wrong with the liquor we've provided for them? Isn't it good enough?
Nothing wrong, really. Only that they'd like someone to share it with, if you get my drift.
Well, there's an Indian reservation ahead of us, a rather large one. In light of what you've said, make it clear to the men that they are not, I repeat, are not, under any circumstances to attempt to bed any of the squaws. Indians are quite strange in their attitude toward women.
If you are their friend and a guest, they will offer you a daughter or a wife to warm your bed and think nothing of it. But if you lay eyes, let alone a hand, on any woman not offered to you, your scalp will decorate their shield. Make certain the men are aware of this. Tell them also that if any of them do pester the Indian women, I'll personally kill them before the bucks have a chance to.
That's pretty damn extreme, sir.
It's meant to be. Now, go and cool their ardor with a little whiskey.
After Gus Yeager departed, Victor Spector returned to the subject of Smoke Jensen.
This little town up north, Du Bois, is ideal for what we want to do. Not so large as to be difficult to take over, yet not so small that we cannot house this little army of ours within the city limits. And from others I've met in prison, Smoke Jensen has a soft spot in his heart for the people of Du Bois. All we need to do is take it over and send word. Smoke Jensen will come to us. Further, if my other little project bears fruit, we'll have a most attractive bait to dangle in front of him.
Two days later, Smoke reached the lodge of Chief Thomas Brokenhorn of the Shoshone at midday. Cook fires sent up their columns of white, while savory odors emanated from the pots supported over them by tripods. Warriors gathered from their homes to form a silent column along which Smoke rode to the central lodge. He couldn't shake the feeling that their formation exactly mimicked that of the punishment gauntlet. He banished the unease when he saw the broad grin on the face of his old friend, Brokenhorn, who stood before his lodge with arms folded over a barrel chest.
You have come far, old friend.
And so have you. You were only leader of the Otter Society when I last saw you.
Thank you, Swift Firestick. Dismount and make my lodge your own. We'll eat, smoke, and talk of old times.
It would be a pleasure, friend Thomas. Although it's recent times I am most interested in.
Yes, some very bad men rode through here yesterday. You must be seeking them. There are many. Come, take of the food of my woman. Burn a pipeful, and then we will talk of these matters.
Monte Carson received a warm welcome from Morgan Crosby. Traveling light and fast, the lawman had made it that far in only 4 days. He filled his belly with some of Morgan's good cooking and settled back with a pipe he had taken to smoke in a late. Finally, Morgan broke one of their frequent long, silent spells.
I reckon you'd be interested in hearing anything about Smoke Jensen.
I didn't come all this way for exercise. He's been here?
Yep. 5 or 6 days ago. Had some right unpleasant fellas on his trail, though.
What did Smoke do about that?
What did we do, you mean?
All right. What did you two do about it?
Yeah. Mind now, I'd never seen Smoke Jensen in action before. He's about as smooth as a well-oiled locomotive. Twixt us, we convinced these fellers it was a bad idea trying to take Smoke in with no more than 5 of them on their side.
Where's the bodies buried?
Well now, Sheriff, there ain't no bodies buried. 'Cause after Smoke rode out, I drug them off to feed the coyotes and buzzards. One of them got away, but he was carrying about 6 of my double-aught buck. Big feller he was, else he'd have been critter bait too.
Crosby went on to describe the fight. Monty finished his bowl, knocked out the dottle, and ground the tobacco embers under one boot sole. He stretched and came upright.
Which way did Smoke head?
That way.
Crosby's finger pointed to the northwest.
Up Yellowstone way.
That fits with what he told me.
Which is?
Smoke's bound for Jackson's Hole.
A fella could take on a small army if he knew his way around there, and I reckon that's what's after him from what I've learned.
Smoke knows the place well enough. Old Preacher taught him every nook and cranny.
Monty extended his hand.
Much obliged for the victuals. Sure sits nice in the belly. There's still a lot of daylight to be used, so I reckon I'll head on out. Plenty of ground between here and the hole.
Come by any time, Sheriff Carson.
Please, call me Monty.
Make it Morgan, then. Be proud to have you stop by and stay a while, and bring your friend with you.
I'll try. Believe me, I will.
A large whole rib cage of elk had been properly demolished, along with stewed squash mixed with nuts, wild onions, and berries. Smoke Jensen related the story of the great elk hunt he had gone on when only a slight bit older than his attentive audience. Some 20 children from the village had gathered around Chief Broken Horn's fire to gawk at the lean white man and hear his exciting stories.
It was a hard ride for me. I was still little enough my legs stuck out from the sides of my pony. Some of you must ride the same way, right? Preacher and I joined with a whole lot of those trappers for this hunt. It would be the biggest ever. Five hands of men came from all parts of the mountains. Preacher, of course, was the best hunter of them all. He was the first to find the herd, first to kill a bull elk. And I got to dress it out. Now, that arrangement didn't last long. By the third day, Preacher let me pick an elk out of the herd and take it as my own. First, he told me,
"Say a little prayer to the bull's high self, asking permission to take its life. Say that you have hunger, and you'll be even more hungry in the long winter to come. Now, ask that the animal spirit be born as the biggest elk of all."
Now, that made my chest swell, and I thought I was really something. Preacher told me he learned to pray like that from the Shoshone.
That's right. He did. In the time of my grandfather. And I remember that hunt. I was no bigger than Susha over there.
Broken Horn indicated a boy of 7 or so, squatted as close as he could get to Smoke Jensen.
Many of us joined in on that hunt, and we all ate well the whole of winter.
Smoke went on to describe the events each day and the shooting of elk with rifles and bow and arrow.
Preacher told me later that 300 bull elk and 50 young elk were taken in that hunt. We made meat for a week after.
Tell us something more.
4 stories is enough for one night. Your fathers will be wondering where you've gone, and your mothers will worry. Go on, I'll have another story in the morning before I leave.
After the last reluctant boy had walked off among the lodges, Smoke realized that he actually was sleepy. He roused himself and headed for the lodge that had been prepared for him. Tomorrow, he would head to the Arapaho camp. Seven hard-faced men rode onto the Sugarloaf early the next morning. They made no effort to conceal their approach from the headquarters building. Earlier, one of them had watched a large contingent of hands ride off to the horse pastures. By his count, only 6 remained to work around the barns and blacksmithy. Well and good, Nate Miller thought. When the Sugarloaf hands had gotten well out of sight and sound of the main ranch buildings, Nate ordered his crew forward. Riding slouched in the saddle, Nate led the outlaws up the steep 2-mile lane from the gate to the ranch yard. He and his men made only slight nods and grunted responses when hailed by the first man to discover them. Looking neither left nor right, they rode on. They passed Stumpy, who looked up from his amble. He made them out right away as gunfighters. He wiped a black smudged hand across his brow to eliminate the sheet of sweat that covered it and watched silently, eyes slitted, as the hard cases brought their horses up to the tie rail outside the kitchen door. There, they dismounted. Still, no one challenged them. Although they had been in several scrapes with Smoke Jensen, the ranch hands were hardly seasoned gunmen. They held back as the strangers started for the door. They soon found they had backed off too long when 2 of the human debris pushed into the kitchen. At last, the 6 hands began to gather around the outlaws, Stumpy in the lead.
What's your business on the Sugarloaf?
If it was any of your business, you'd have been told.
The rat-faced individual who was speaking laid his right hand on the smooth butt of his .45 Colt. Stumpy took up the challenge.
Mayhap you didn't hear too well. This here's the Sugarloaf, Smoke Jensen's ranch. Being as how we belong here and you don't, that makes it our business. What are you here for? And who sent you?
Old-timer, you really don't want to know.
A A few moments earlier, Sally Jensen had looked up when the kitchen door had swung open. Surprise had washed over her face when she saw the two unfamiliar men.
What are you doing here?
The lean, lanky one, who she would later learn was named Nate Miller, spoke.
Are you Sally Jensen?
Yes, I am.
We come to take you on a little visit.
I think not. I have no plans to go anywhere, especially with the likes of you. Get out of my kitchen.
When we go, we're taking you with us.
Sally's purse lay in the middle of the table. She made a quick grab for it and produced her .38 Colt Lightning. She had already begun her squeeze through on the double action rig when she spoke again.
Get out of my kitchen!
Sally came out of her chair with enough force to knock it over. One leg splintered when it struck the floor. Already, Miller had moved to the side. The other thug turned to open the door. Sally fired then. The slug cracked past close enough to the outlaw that he felt the hot wind from it. Nate Miller dived at her from her blind side. Fingers like iron slats closed around her wrist.
Give me that, bitch!
She fought like a fury. Her nails clawed Nate's cheek. He managed to get the web of his other hand between the hammer and the rear of the receiver of Sally's Colt Lightning. The sharp little firing pin bit deeply into his skin. Sally stomped on his arch and then brought a knee up toward his groin. Only because he moved his right thigh did she fail to do him severe damage. Ignoring the deep gouges on his cheek, he used his bloody hand to shake her violently.
Let go of that gun!
He slammed her head into the point of his shoulder. Sally bit him on the arm.
Shit! Bitch!
Miller punched her on the side of her head. Sally saw a wild burst of stars behind her eyes, and her knees sagged. It relaxed her grip on the revolver. It fell to the floor. Miller spun Sally around and took hold of both her shoulders. He shook her like one would an errant child.
Listen to me. You're coming with us. Either over my shoulder or on your own 2 feet, you're coming. I don't much care which it is. Bart, give me a hand.
Bart crossed the room to where Nate held the dark-haired woman. Each man took an arm and marched her to the door. Nate Miller turned sideways and led the way out, dragging Sally behind him. When she appeared outside as a captive, the hands went for their guns. Stumpy let fly with the hammer. Driven by the power of the blacksmith's muscular arm, the heavy object slammed into the forehead of the rat-faced thug. He went down like a slaughterhouse steer. A swift exchange of lead followed. One bullet cracked by close enough to cut the knot on the headband Stumpy wore.
Damn!
Momentarily, the sodden cloth fell over his eyes.
Man up, boys! Get the hell out of here!
Nate roughly threw Sally onto the saddle and then mounted himself. He led the way down the lane towards safety. Quickly, his underlings followed suit. Behind them, Stumpy counted up the toll.
One of them dead, one of ours. These two of them wounded, three of ours. What's worse, though, is they got Miss Sally. It's gonna be hell to pay for that.
Ike Mitchell and the hands with him returned after being summoned by a shaken Sugarloaf worker.
Get everyone who's able gathered up, Stumpy. We'll pick a skeleton crew to maintain things here. The rest will ride after those bastards.
Just what I had in mind.
When everyone collected around Ike Mitchell, he outlined his plans. At once, the hands who would accompany him went about making ready. It didn't take long for Ike to see Bobby lead his mount to the corral rails and climb up to tie on his bedroll. Ike crossed to him.
Now, I'm sorry, Bobby. You're not going along.
Yes. Yes, I am. It's my fault anyway. I should have gone with Smoke. We could have stopped those guys long before now.
Bobby, that's not realistic. Smoke is miles from here, and these fellas came from who knows where. You can't come with us. Smoke and Miss Sally would never forgive me.
I've got to go, Ike. She's my mother.
Something ripped inside Ike Mitchell. Buried memories flared up of himself as a boy of 12 standing over the grave of his mother, killed by Injuns.
All right, Bobby. You bring that little carbine of yours and your six gun. We leave in 10 minutes.
Smoke Jensen bid farewell to Chief Brokenhorn early that morning. The chief clasped Smoke's forearm and nodded toward the northwest.
Go carefully, old friend. I will keep braves to watch the evil ones. I promise you that when you need them, warriors will come to help you.
That could get you in a lot of trouble for leaving the reservation armed and without an army escort.
We are no strangers to the white man's trouble. Ride in peace and send word when men are needed.
Thank you, old friend. May your lodge always have ample food.
A twinkle filled the eyes of Brokenhorn.
You go now to those snakes in the grass.
Ah, what a thing to call the Arapaho.
Old ways die hard. Old enemies even harder.
Hey, I heard that. And yes, I'm going to go talk with Black Robe. I'll give him your best.
What does this best mean?
Better you didn't know. Ah!
Smoke rode off toward the Arapaho encampment. At the head of the column of vengeful ranch hands, Ike Mitchell soon noted that the trail of the kidnappers led roughly in the same direction Smoke said he would be taken. He said nothing of it at the time, content to be assured they quickly closed ground. Sally Jensen was a plucky lady. He felt confident that she would do anything she could to slow down her abductors. Bobby Harris kept up pretty well. Not once did the boy complain of the fast pace or the ache that must have been in full bloom in his thighs and crotch. They rode on through the afternoon. 20 miles out of each hour, they walked their horses to keep them from becoming blown. If the outlaws failed to do the same, well, the chances of coming on them soon increased considerably. By the time the western sky turned magenta, they had not yet made contact. Reluctantly, Ike called a halt for the day. While the hands went about to set up a camp, Ike took Bobby aside.
Bobby, I want you to promise me one thing. When the shooting starts, you hold back. I want you out of the mix-up as far as you can be. You'll have a chance to get in your licks. I want you to pick a spot from which you can watch and see any of the outlaws try to escape. If they do, you pot them.
Yeah, I can do that.
Good man.
Ike resisted the impulse to pat Bobby on the head and just nodded instead. When the last of the red-eye gravy had been sopped up with the last biscuit and the final bit of ham had been munched contentedly, Ike Mitchell called the hands together around the fire. He informed them of the likelihood that the outlaws were headed for the same place as Smoke Jensen. He also advised that they had a good chance of catching up the next day. When the wranglers of the Sugarloaf had digested that, he asked for suggestions about what to do when they caught the kidnappers in the open. The most popular suggestion involved roping them by the ankles and dragging the bastards.
Remember one thing. Those fellers have Miss Sally with them. We'll have to be mighty careful with any shooting we do. Best thing I think we can do is find them and get around them and set up an ambush. Two of us could make a grab for Miss Sally while the rest of the outlaws trying to escape the ambush.
That's reasonable.
Bobby Harris summed up their general attitude with his quiet, simple statement.
I say we kill them all.
Deep, rhythmic throbbing came from the big, singing drum of the Arapaho village. A huge fire burned nearby with the chief and elders seated before it with their honored guest. Smoke Jensen leaned back on a porcupine quill decorated backrest and gnawed on a rib bone. The meat was sweet and rich. In the chill of the High Plains night, smaller fires flickered in every lodge, making themselves a vast display of huge skin lanterns. When the gunfighter licked his fingers to signal he was through eating, Chief Blackrobe produced a pipe, lighted it with the coal from the fire, and made the 6 points. Then he passed the calumet to Smoke Jensen, who did the same as his host, took a long draw for himself, and began to speak of his reason for being there.
A moon ago, 3 bad men escaped from Yuma Prison in far-off Arizona. They've taken a vow to hunt and kill me. I do not fear them. They are only three. But they've taken a gang to themselves. Dangerous men. Made all the more so because they're not the best at what they do. They number many times two hands.
Smoke paused to let that sink in.
It is said that these men have ridden into this country. Though why they've come here, I do not know.
Silence followed for a while, during which Smoke passed the pipe on. At last, Black Robe spoke.
We have seen such men. As you say, they number many. They rode through here two suns ago. I did not like their looks, though in truth they did no harm. So I sent young warriors to watch over their progress. I would believe that they are the same men of which you speak. If so, you could use some help. I promise to take this up with the council. If approved, men can be sent whenever you need them.
Bound hand and foot, Sally Jensen sat on a rock, apart from the scruffy band of thugs who had taken her captive. She was cold, hungry, and miserable, though determined not to let her captors know that. One of the hard cases separated from the rest and came toward her. He carried a tin plate and a spoon.
I have some grub here. Brung you some water, too. I'll untie your hands so you can eat if you promise not to make a fuss.
I doubt I could keep down anything cooked by the likes of you.
Well, you'd be surprised. All Hank's a fair to middling cook. If you aim to live through this, you'll need to eat to keep up your strength.
I suppose you are right. I promise not to try to escape while my hands are free.
I'm sure you won't, because I'm going to sit here and watch you.
Quickly, Sally's hands were freed and she held the plate.
Where are you taking me?
The man saw no reason not to respond.
North, to a little town named Du Bois. The boss says that your husband will come there to get you free.
If he does, you can be sure you will all regret the day it happens.
I doubt that, lady. There's 38 of us. More than enough to face down Smoke Jensen.
Are you sure? What do you really know about my husband?
The outlaw considered that a moment.
I ain't never seen him, ma'am. But I hear he's one ringtail heller when he's riled.
Sally smiled inwardly, pleased with this response.
That's true enough. He and three others took on more than 50 men one time. Smoke was shot twice, but he killed or wounded 20 of them by himself.
God damn! Oh, excuse my cussing, ma'am. He's a bit more than most of these fellas are expecting. Some of us is pretty good, but not that good.
Another time, he took on 13 men in the middle of the street by himself. Five of them died. The other eight received one or more wounds. Smoke just took a crease across the top of his left shoulder.
Well, that's powerful good shooting, ma'am.
I thought you ought to know. Perhaps it would be wise for you to make the others aware of these things.
Oh. Yeah, I do think you're right.
Another of the outlaws walked up. A hulking brute, he smelled of tobacco smoke, stale whiskey, and unwashed body. A broken-toothed grin shined yellowish in the reflected firelight. Fists on hips, he took a long, slow look at Sally Jensen. Abruptly, he reached out and chucked her under the chin. His thick thumb and forefinger squeezed Sally painfully.
Oh!
Well, now, I reckon it's time for us to get a little relief, don't you, Sam?
With his other hand, he massaged his crotch suggestively. Sally's confidant, Sam, bristled immediately.
Well, you heard what Nate said, and Mr. Spectre, too. She ain't to be touched.
You calling me out, Sam?
I reckon, if needs be.
Nate Miller appeared out of nowhere. He gave the surly thug a hard shove.
Get back where you belong! You too, Sam. Once Ms. Jensen is fed, anyway.
Nate tipped his hat to Sally.
I'm sorry, ma'am, if Ogilvy upset you. He knows better. Or at least he should have. I'll have Sam here rig you a safe place to sleep.
Thank you. You are so kind.
That night, silently, Sally hatched plan after plan on how to escape. And rejected them all.
But the time will come. It surely will.
Ike Mitchell sat his horse, his face a mask of dejection. The trail they had followed so far had completely disappeared. He pointed to the multiple tracks that led into a swiftly flowing stream. Early that morning, they had ridden hard and fast to the north to get around the outlaws. An ideal spot had been picked for an ambush, and the Sugarloaf hands had settled in to wait. When the kidnappers had not appeared by noon, Ike had to conclude that they had taken a new trail. He sent three men southeast along the way by which he expected the outlaws to approach. They found a camp and a trail that led off to due west. Hastily, one returned to inform Ike, and he immediately started off in pursuit of the new route. Fogging along the new path, they eventually came to this fast-flowing mountain stream.
Those horses were trailing, went in this stream right about here. Yeah, only they did not come out on the other side. 50-50 chance for up or downstream.
Ike considered it a while, then consulted the others.
You boys have tracked enough horses in your time. What do you say? They go up or down?
I say up, in keeping with they going to Wyoming.
Yeah, I agree, Stumpy. Good point. Three of you trail south downstream for about 4 miles. If you don't cut any sign, turn around and join up with us as soon as you can.
Whew. Monte Carson sweated bullets. The hot sun beat down on the waving sea of grass in the Great Divide Basin. He felt gratitude that Hank Evans had come along. Never complaining, that big smile plastered on his freckled face even in this heat. Hank rode at Monty's side. Bareheaded, Hank's carroty hair could be a flaming torch. They had covered considerable ground in the past 2 days since leaving the cabin of Morgan Crosby. Only today's ride and they would be in the Green Mountains. If all went well, they would negotiate them by the end of the next day. Monty chafed at any delay in catching up to Smoke. Even if he only got word of the gunfighter's passage, he would feel better. 35 to 40 men in the Spectre gang? The words haunted him. Monty honestly doubted that the three of them could go against such numbers and come out of it alive. At least not all of them. Would it be Hank Evans who got it? Or would he cash in his chips at long last? Never once did Monty consider that Smoke Jensen might be sent off to meet his maker. Smoke was the stuff legends are made of. He was as close to being immortal as any man could hope to be. Self-consciously, Monty forced himself off this path of introspection. Last thing he needed before going into a shootout was to worry about the outcome. Years as a fast gun and even more as a lawman had taught him that. He turned to look at his chief deputy.
What say I go off and find us something for supper?
Wait until we're in the mountains.
I hear there's some pigs that gone wild up there in the greens. Mighty tasty.
Exactly what I was thinking. Roast one of them whole and bring along what we don't need for tomorrow.
Yeah, a young porker'd be real fine.
Half an hour later, they came upon a pair of scruffy road agents who had stopped off to rob a hapless family of four who had broken a wagon wheel. Monty spotted them first, the man and woman frightened witless, hands in the air, while the human trash rifled their clothing for valuables. Two children were cowering behind the jacked up wheel. Monty had a 6-gun out of leather before thinking about it. So engrossed were the thieves that they failed to notice the approach of the lawmen. Monty got within 20 yards of the pinched-faced one before the bit of crud raised a sallow, startled face to stare at the threat of a .45 Colt. Unable to shoot because of the proximity of the victims, Monty anticipated that the outlaw would not be so inhibited. He jinked to the right a moment before the craven robber fired. The shooter jumped to one side to get a clearer shot at his intended target. Monty seized on the change of position to get off a round. It struck the miscreant in the center of his chest, punched through a lung, and severed the aorta. The thug literally bled to death before he realized he was dying. His legs went out from under him, and he flopped on the ground. His partner exchanged shots with Hank and dived for the protection of the damaged wagon. Hank sent more lead after him. The slug cut chips from the wagon's sideboard. Meanwhile, Monte Carson edged his horse to the offside of the buckboard and stood in place to meet the brigand when he rounded the harness team.
What the hell?
Throw it down.
Hell no!
Monty's horse shied just at the instant when he fired. His bullet went wide and low to gouge deeply into the road agent's hip. The hoodlum dropped to his good knee. His colt bucked and snorted fire. The slug cut a hot line along Monty's rib cage. Then Monty's peacemaker spoke, and the highwayman flipped over backward. Monty and Hank checked the dead man and turned back to the startled pilgrims. The blonde woman's hands were clasped and upraised.
Praise the Lord. You saved us, mister. We're much obliged.
No thanks to the both of you. Folks should know better not to be out here unarmed or without an escort.
We do not believe in guns, mister. They're the work of the devil.
Marty's right, mister. We don't hold by guns in violent ways.
The man cut his eyes to inspect the aftermath.
At least, she don't. After what happened, I sort of changed my mind.
Richard!
No, I mean it, Marty. They might have done who knows what to you and the girls after they robbed us, that is. You saw what a man properly armed could do to end their evil ways.
Such matters are best left in the hands of God and the law.
And just how long do you expect it might have taken for God to take a hand, or the law to get here? We'd all be dead and turned back to dust before we could count on any help from them quarters. And I don't mean to blaspheme, but God's got other things to look after, and the nearest law must be 100 miles away.
As it happens, the law is right here. Monte Carson, Sheriff of Price County, Colorado. This is my chief deputy.
We still in Colorado?
Nope. This is Wyoming, right enough. We're looking for a man.
An outlaw?
No, a friend. Tall man, lean, with broad shoulders, clean-shaven, far-off-looking hazel eyes, red-brown hair.
Richard cut his eyes to his wife. They both shook their heads.
We've not seen anyone like that.
Don't reckon you will, then. He should be ahead of us a ways. Can we give you a hand with that wheel?
I'd be right grateful. Got a spare lashed to the underside.
Within 20 minutes, the new wheel had been fixed in place. Monty wiped axle grease off his hands and turned to his horse.
I can't thank you enough. What's to be done with these two?
Richard pointed to the dead man.
No doubt they have a price on their heads. If you can put up with a stink, take them along and turn them in at the next town.
Richard, not on your life!
I think we'll pass on the opportunity.
Suit yourself.
Monty gave a friendly wave. Then he and Hank rode off once again in search of Smoke Jensen. Seen from a long, ragged bluff, the town of Du Bois looked even more unimpressive than the description given of it by Victor Spector. 3 days of hard riding, from first light to last, had brought him to this point finally. The gang sat their mounts near the rim that dropped off sharply to a talus slope 300 feet below. A beatific smile lighted the face of Victor Spector. He made a sweeping gesture with a black-gloved hand.
There it is, gentlemen. We have arrived. We will divide into 4 groups. 3 of them to be led by myself and my associates, the 4th by Augustus Jaeger. We will then approach the town from all sides and take it by storm. The key is to minimize the amount of violence it requires to assert our control. Paramount is the disarming of the populace.
Farley Huntoon looked blankly at Reese Judson.
What the hell he say?
He says first we take away all their guns.
Are you straight on that, Huntoon?
Oh, yeah.
Good. 2nd is to make certain that only a selected few escape to carry word of conditions in Du Bois. I would suggest no more than 2 or 3, and separately. Lastly is to secure all means of communication to the outside world. After that, you are at liberty to despoil the community and its citizens to your heart's content. Mind you, that is to be in moderation. We do not want the town burned down around our feet.
Rustling petticoats never started no fires, Mr. Spector. I reckon to keep my despoiling to the ladies of Du Bois, and that's a fact.
Spector gave the man a cold smile.
Fine, Mr. Brock. 1 final admonition. You are not all to celebrate at the same time. An endless orgy is not in my plans. You must all get proper rest and sleep. We also need men on the alert to keep watch. Augustus Jaeger and Rhys Judson will be in charge of a system of lookouts. Because when he gets word, Smoke Jensen will come. And when he does, it will be as though all the furies of hell rode with him. Enough for now. Let us divide and prepare to conquer.
Irving Spawn had opened his bank in Du Bois the year before a horde of outlaws had descended upon the town. 2 months after their arrival, Smoke Jensen came to Du Bois. After a lot of bloody fighting, the outlaws, at least those left alive, fled. Irving had proudly aided in their expulsion. He still prided himself at being good with a shotgun. Even though he had reached the age of 55 and had a pot belly, he still got out and hunted prairie chickens, doves, and Canada geese. Many a winter afternoon after the bank had closed, he would arrive at home with a pair of plump rabbits. It had been 2 years now since anyone had tried to rob the bank. On that occasion, the unlucky bandit had been blasted into eternity by Irving's trusty Parker. At the bank, he loaded double-aught buckshot. On this bright, sunny day, as Irving had stepped outside to lock the door for the noontime recess, he had felt confident that all was and would remain well with his world. He would soon discover how sadly wrong he had been. Seated at his usual table at Molly Vincent's home kettle, he awaited a savory plate of corned beef and cabbage with potatoes, onions, and carrots. Suddenly, the double front doors flew open with enough force to shatter the etched edge glass in one panel. 3 men stood in the opening and menaced everyone inside with huge six guns and gloved fists.
Nobody make a sound. Just sit still and don't make trouble. My friends here are gonna come around and relieve all you gents of any weapons you may have. Then I'm gonna name some people I want to stand up and come with us.
The fat male cook and owner, Molson, who was called Molly by everyone, took a step forward.
You can't get away with this!
I don't see anything around here that could get in our way. Now, don't even twitch an eyelid. Go clean them out, boys.
Quickly, the outlaws complied. They came up with 5 cartridge belts and holster rigs, 2 pocket pistols, and a derringer, owned by Vera Pritchard, who operated Miss Pritchard's residence for refined young ladies, which was actually the local sporting house. 6 other men who had been taking their noon meal, including Irving Spawn, had been unarmed. Irving thought longingly of his shotgun, which lie at rest beside his desk in the bank.
Ain't enough money in this place to make it worth robbing. The risk's too big.
Oh, we ain't here to rob you. We've decided to settle down a while, sort of become your neighbors.
Well, that's ridiculous. Why, the army would come, gather you all up, and hang you.
Not if we lived right in among you, in your houses.
You can't do that. It's against the law.
So's robbing you of everything you got. And that's exactly what we are aiming to do right after we kill Smoke Jensen.
Being a friend of Smoke's, Molly attempted a bluff.
Who? Never heard anybody by that name.
Then you can't read in your ears, you stuff full of wax. Ain't nobody don't know Smoke Jensen.
That's enough, Huntoon. Though he's right. Jensen's supposed to be the big hero around here. Saved your town. Ain't that right?
Yeah, ain't it?
Huntoon!
I'm done.
Irving Spawn finally spoke.
Yes, you're entirely correct. Smoke Jensen did save our town. And may I add that if he were here, you sorry trash would be running for your lives or on your way to the cemetery. Now kindly leave us to our meal.
Sorry, can't do that. I want the fallen folks to stand up. The banker, the saddle maker, the general store owner, the lady that runs that fancy whore house, the feed and grain store owner, the haberdasher. Did I forget anybody?
Oh, yeah. The Sawbones, whose shingle is hanging out over the ladies' wear shop. And the lawyer.
Reginald Barkley, the only attorney in private practice in Du Bois, did not rise.
This is outrageous. What do you intend doing with us?
Cold gray eyes pinned Barkley to the wall.
Killing you if you don't do as we say.
Very well.
The sudden violence outside the restaurant made the fact abundantly clear, even to the dull-witted Huntoon, that the takeover did not go as peacefully elsewhere. Hand working frantically to stuff fresh shells into the open breech of his greener double barrel, Percy Latimer, the Du Bois barber, kept his eyes fixed on the two hard cases sprawled in the street. Terrible damage had been done by the loads of double-aught buckshot he had fired into their midsections. Large, thick pools of blood had formed around them while they lay gaping at the sky with unseeing eyes. From across the street, two of the outlaw's companions continued to trash Percy's tonsorial parlor. Fragments of glass painted in a red, white, and green diamond pattern lay on the floor all around Percy. It would cost a pretty penny to replace that. He seated the final cartridge, eased shut the breech, and checked the release lever to make certain it had caught properly. A figure moved behind a water barrel. Percy cocked the greener. Exposing only part of his head and one shoulder, Percy swung up the shotgun.
He got my gun arm!
Shoot left-handed!
I can't hit a blessed thing that way!
But you can keep that bastard's head down while I rush him!
I never thought of that!
Oh, you never thought no-how, Louie! Now get ready!
Louie sent rounds flying wildly into the barber shop. The huge bevel-edged mirror turned into a thousand slivers of quicksilver. Percy's favorite shaving mug disintegrated in a shower of crockery. Percy winced, then rose up swiftly and caught sight of a shadowy figure. Bent low, the hard case ran along the front of the saloon. Percy brought the greener into line. Buckshot from the 10-gauge took out the bandit and a portion of a window behind him. Jake went ass over tea kettle through the now wide open window, slammed by 10 pellets of burning lead. Percy pushed the catch and opened the breech loader. Spent brass casings popped up and he pulled them free. He replaced them with fresh ones. Then he swung the shotgun into line again. Suddenly, an intense white pain exploded in Percy's skull and his head snapped backward. The greener dropped to the floor.
Woo-hoo! I got him, Jake!
Bert the bartender and six customers in the Yellow Gulch Saloon found themselves confronted by eight armed men. Fortunately, depending on how one looked at it, three of the customers had reputations for being good with their guns. In an instant, even before any demand for money could be made, the air filled with lead. Bullets flew from both sides. Even with their disadvantage of first having to draw, the customers put slugs into a pair of outlaws and forced the others to retreat outside. Hands gripped tightly on the forestock of a short-barreled 10-gauge Wells Fargo shotgun, Bert called encouragement to his assistants.
Drinks on the house for anybody who kills one of them devils.
Well, for how many and how long?
The whole day, from opening to closing time, and for the one who gets the job done.
How about his friends?
Yeah, goddammit, them too!
Their doom came home to them a moment later when a voice called from outside.
Come out with your hands high, or we'll throw in a stick of dynamite.
Dynamite? Stick-up men don't carry dynamite? Where would they have gotten that?
I sure as shit don't want to stick around and find out.
Well, if we do go out there, we're dead men, you know that. We killed two of their partners.
Last chance! Come out or die there!
I'd rather die in here fighting like a man than go out there and get shot down like a dog.
Bert slammed the shotgun to his shoulder as he saw a dark figure rushing at the swinging doors. The outlaw flew back into a tie rail and spun a flip over it. Something sputtering a stream of sparks dropped between his legs.
Get down! They weren't bluffing!
A moment later, the whole front of the saloon blew in on top of him. Bert found out after the Fuhrer ended that none had expired in the blast. Hard hands dragged him clear of the wreckage and roughly shoved him into the street. Gus Yeager stood in the center of the block, legs widespread, arms folded over his chest.
Brings him here. Puts him on their knees.
When they had the seven men positioned as Yeager wanted, the outlaw leader looked down at the helpless bartender and his customers.
So, you killed three of my men. Which ones of you did it?
Only silence answered him. Gus drew his Colt and put the muzzle an inch from the back of the head of a barfly.
Tell me, who did the shooting?
Again, they all remained silent. Gus Yeager squeezed the trigger. He blew the face of the town drunk all over the street.
You murdering bastard!
How about it, bartender? Who did the shooting?
Go!
Gus shot Bert. Then another. Suddenly bored and disgusted, he turned to his underlings.
Give me a hand, boys. We'll just kill them all.
Within half an hour, a totally unsatisfactory time for Victor Spector, all resistance had been crushed. Spector rode in splendor to the central intersection of the community. There, a windmill and storage tank provided water for the entire town. A bandstand stood there also. Spector dismounted before it and climbed the steep flight of steps. He faced the frightened people gathered there and took the report from Gus Yeager.
All who resisted us have been killed. The rest are here. We only lost seven men, nine wounded. Most of the injured will be up and round by tomorrow.
Too many. This was supposed to be quiet and easy.
Ralph Tinsdale joined Spector.
I'd say these folks are not aware of that.
Victor Spector shot Ralph a hard, hot stare.
You are not funny, Ralph. Where do you suppose we will find men to replace those lost?
Smoke Jensen is only one man, Victor.
But he will come with an army. We need ours intact to face him.
Spector paused and turned away to study the confused and terrified people.
I have something to tell these people.
From his position in the front row, Irving Spawn got a good look at the man who must be the leader of the enemy. That's how he looked at these invaders, the enemy. In his mind's eye, Irvin even saw the capital letters on the word enemy. He had noted earlier, after opening his bank to the outlaw scum, that Dr. Frederick Barber, had been pressed into service to tend the wounded. Not the injured town folk, but the enemy wounded. Irving silently hoped that Dr. Fred would hurry a few of them on to meet their maker. Unfortunately, Barber was a delicate healer. He could no more harm a patient than take his own life. Irving closely watched the exchange between the foreman and the boss. Then the man in charge turned to face the assembled townspeople. He raised his arms.
Good afternoon. My name is Victor Spector. I have come here for a cause that needn't concern you. Shortly, some of my men will escort you to your place of business and your homes. The purpose of their visit is to obtain every firearm you possess and all of the ammunition.
A burly retired rancher interrupted.
We got a right to own guns.
Spector shook his head sadly, as though faced with a truculent but dim-witted child.
Not when they might endanger some of my men. Believe me, it is for your own good. Some of your friends and neighbors have already died because they chose to resist us. From now, until we leave this town, we are in charge. You will obey us without question or hesitation.
Like hell we will!
Spector turned to his foreman.
Augustus, shoot him.
Faster than any man in that town had ever seen except Smoke Jensen, this Gus had drawn a six-gun and fired. The bullet had entered the open mouth of the rancher and exited low in the back of his neck. He went down loosely, an unstrung marionette. Smiling pleasantly, Spector turned his attention back to his horrified audience.
I will repeat. You will obey without hesitation or question. Now, another matter. Singly or by twos, my men will be divided off and you will provide for them in your homes. They will have a room to themselves and you will cook for them. In return, they will leave you strictly alone. This is to be merely a board and room situation. They are under orders to take their pleasures elsewhere. Such will remain the case unless some of you become obstreperous, in which case my men will be free to exact recompense in any manner they see fit. Do we understand one another? I can't hear you.
Victor Spector nodded meaningfully to Gus Yeager.
I can't hear you!
To Irving Spawn's disgust, his fellow citizens seemed mesmerized by this petty dictator. Their timidity had the reverse effect.
I still can't hear you! That's better. You will answer loudly, promptly, and truthfully any and all questions asked by myself, my associates, or my men. From here on, until our departure, this is our town.
Quickly, then, Gus Yeager designated men to take the residents to their stores and homes. Thorough searches were made. The outlaw foreman took three men along with him when they went to search the mercantile. Shortly after entering, two of the trash emerged with wheelbarrows heaped high with cases of ammunition, armloads of rifles, and half a dozen handguns. When the search ended, Yeager escorted Irwin to the bank. Then he surveyed the vault and the two freestanding safes. Satisfied, he nodded.
This seems secure enough. We'll keep the money here until we're ready to leave town. Now, you take me to your home. We'll have a little look there. No doubt the mayor has the nicest house in town. Victor and his partners will stay there. As no doubt the next richest man in town, you will have the pleasure of hosting me.
I am flattered and honored at the privilege.
Yeager glowered and raised his hand menacingly.
And the more smart mouthing will earn you a fat lip.
My wife keeps a kosher kitchen.
I don't care what she calls it, Mr. Banker. So long as it's clean and there's plenty of grub.
Kosher means pure, clean.
Good for her. Now, I want ham and eggs and biscuits for every breakfast.
We do not eat ham or any pork.
Gus cocked an eyebrow. You never heard of such nonsense.
Well, she'll fix it for me. You don't have to eat it if you don't want to.
You don't understand. If my wife cooks pork in our kitchen, it is no longer kosher. It will be contaminated.
I don't give a damn about that. So long as there's not cockroaches crawling everywhere and moldy food laying around, I'll eat what I want and you can do the same.
She will cook for you in the wash house. I will not allow my kitchen to be tainted.
To Irvin Spawn's surprise, Gus Yeager didn't hit him.
By God, you're a feisty son, aren't you? All right, Mr.
Spawn. Irving Spawn.
Mr. Spawn, have it your way. Just so long as I have my ham and eggs, biscuits, and some fried potatoes would be nice. Do you folks eat, beef?
Yes, of course.
Well then. Have the missus pick up a nice roast at the meat market for tonight.
How is this food of yours to be paid for?
The usual way you pay for anything you buy. With your own money.
Once all of the arms and ammunition had been confiscated, Olin Buckner came to where Victor Spector stood beside the great pile of munitions.
This has gone nicely. Men who are unable to resist must obey.
Before long, the poor fools will find themselves totally dependent upon you, me, and Ralph for the barest necessities for survival.
That's how it should be. The best and the brightest should rule, and lesser mortals submit.
The next thing is to pair up the men whose homes we've searched with their wives and children and place them in their houses under guard. Those who are involved in providing services in the stores, saloons, the bank, the hotel, and cafe are to be sent to their tasks.
What about any single men?
Spectre made a show of considering it, even though he had made his mind up long before he ever entered town.
Now they could provide a constant risk. We'll have some of the more hardened among our men take them off a few at a time. We can offer them the chance to join us. If they refuse, they can dig their own graves before being shot.
When the last of the single males refused the offer to join the gang and had been mercilessly shot down, Victor Spector turned his attention to the single women. Those he kept in the central square while the killing went on. He then surveyed all his men. Back on the bandstand, he commended his gang for their bravery. He then gestured to the frightened, weeping women, some as young as 14, and offered them as a reward for their outstanding service. Private hotels were provided for the gang members. That night, corridors of the Du Bois Hotel rang with the sounds of brutal rape. Early on the morning of the second day in Du Bois, Gus Yeager stepped out on the porch of the home of Irving Spawn. He had already rolled a cigarette with papers and tobacco from the pouch of Bull Durham in his shirt pocket. He lighted it, drew the smoke deeply into his chest, and held it a while. Then he sighed it out with satisfaction. His belly was full of the sweetest ham he had ever tasted. 4 eggs, home fries with onions, and a whole platter of biscuits. Pleased with himself, he ankled down the steps and headed for the carriage house at the back of the lot. There, he saddled his horse and took it out into the alley. Finally, he swung into the saddle. At a gentle walk, Gus headed toward the mayor's house. He was to meet with Victor Spector and his partners there. He found them still at the breakfast table. Victor commanded the maid standing in attendance on the table.
Pour Mr. Yeager a cup of coffee. Did you sleep well, Augustus?
Yes, thank you. That Mrs. Spawn is a great cook. I've never had beef so tender and juicy. We had roast last night, with braised potatoes and something she called
asparagus. A meal fit for a king. Well, we have a lot to do today. Let's talk in the drawing room.
Victor Spector ushered Gus into the small room, made to look larger by a bay window. Spector settled on a Louis Quinze, a cup and saucer in one hand.
Now then, I want you to select 6 men to act as messengers. I will send them out with flyers I'm having printed today. I'm putting a price of $20,000 on the head of Smoke Jensen. The posters will advise anyone interested in trying for the reward to come here to Du Bois. I am also offering excellent pay, board, and room until Jensen is captured and brought to me to kill.
That is mighty generous, Mr. Spector. Are our men eligible for that bonus?
Of course, Augustus. I conceived of this idea last night. It's a splendid way to refill our ranks, maybe tenfold of our losses. Also, it serves as insurance in the event my primary ploy to draw Jensen to us fails.
No offense, but you'll have every proddy son of a bitch in 3 territories crowding in here. Half of them won't be able to use a gun. We'll have one hell of a time keeping control.
Not to worry. That's what your veterans are for. They took this town. They should have pride enough in it to keep down the rowdy element.
You know people rather well, don't you, Mr. Spector?
Victor's chest swelled. He all but patted himself on the damn back.
I pride myself on that, Augustus. Now, make sure that business is conducted as usual. See that those quartered with the merchants and businessmen get their charges out and about. We can't entirely prevent people from coming into town. If we isolate ourselves, it would attract too much attention. So, I want you to arrange to have any damage covered up, make that unfortunate situation with the saloon look like a fire, and clean up the spilled blood.
Rising from the velvet love seat he occupied, Gus Yeager started for the door.
I'll see to it right away.
Victor Spector allowed himself a moment to gloat as he stared out at the 3-sided opening of the bay window. Then he smiled softly.
Smoke Jensen, your hours are surely numbered.